Now, yesterday, after considering the forensic character of justification, we moved more specifically to a consideration of soteric justification, beginning with the observation or beginning with the theme of the imputation of righteousness. And yesterday, under this first point, soteric justification requires a constitutive act, I sought to argue theologically for such a constitutive act in this fashion, that on the one hand, the declaration or the judgment that is passed with respect to us is a judgment to the effect that we are righteous. But on the other hand, we are not righteous in and of ourselves. And then also the justifying verdict is not a transformation of us, but is, as we saw earlier, a verdict with respect to us. And when you try to put all of that together, you're driven to recognize that in this justifying verdict, there is some sort of what Professor Murray calls constitutive act. Now, where he gets that word from will become apparent in a moment. But it's a constitutive act that makes the declaration involved in justification to be a declaration according to truth, a constitutive act which does not consist of internal or inward renewal, but is of a different order, consonant with the forensic character of justification. And that constitutive act supplies the proper ground for the declaration. Now, we not only argue for that theologically, but we also see such an act represented to us in Romans 5:19. Romans 5:19. And if you look at that, for as through the transgression of the one man, the many were constituted sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man, the many are constituted or will be constituted righteous. And there you have explicit reference to a constitutive act, Romans 5:19, for as through the one man's disobedience, the many. And in most translations it reads, the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous. That seems to be the pervasive translation in English. But the word is kathistemi. And in the passive, can be translated constituted. The many are constituted righteous. And that constitution of them as righteous is parallel to the fact that by the disobedience of the one, the many were constituted sinners. So there is a constitutive act which enters into justification. Now, in the context, Romans 5:19, it is clear that the Apostle Paul is talking about justification and not about regeneration or sanctification. If we were talking about regeneration or sanctification, we might think of this being made or being constituted righteous as some kind of personal transformation. But in the context, he is talking about justification. For example, in verse 18b, through the one act of righteousness, there resulted justification of life to all men. You go back another verse, the last half of verse 17. Those who receive the abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. Go back another verse to 16. On the other hand, the free gift arose from many transgressions, resulting in justification. And that repeated reference to justification and righteousness leads us to understand the expression in verse 17 as having reference to the same phenomenon, namely to justification. The text as a whole has to do with the contrast between sin, condemnation, and death on the one hand, and righteousness, justification, and life on the other. So that in terms of Romans 5:19, justification is, or probably better, includes a constitutive act. A reference to that constitutive act may also probably be present in verse 17. For if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through the one, much more those who receive the abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. There is, in terms of that verse, a free gift of righteousness which is received. And that would seem to go beyond the idea in verse 18, which speaks simply of the one act of righteousness resulting in justification to life. Indeed, it does result in justification. But beyond that, there is a free gift of righteousness which is received. There is a bestowment of righteousness. And that bestowment which is received would seem to be in the same sphere as the constitutive act in verse 19. So we have not only a theological argument which leads us to think in terms of a constitutive act, but we have also explicit biblical warrant for that. Is that point clear? Okay, I don't want to rush the thing if you're not with me, but if you're with me, I'm very happy to press on ahead. Okay, the third point is this, that the constitutive act is the imputation of righteousness. The constitutive act is the imputation of righteousness. What we're saying here is that that act which is referred to in Romans 5:19 is to be understood in conjunction with the way in which the Scripture speaks of the imputation of righteousness. There are two texts where that is explicit. Romans 4, verse 6. Romans 4, verse 6, just as David also speaks of the blessing upon the man to whom God reckons righteousness apart from work. And verse 11 of Romans 4, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be reckoned to them. In both of those verses, you have the expression that righteousness is imputed or is reckoned to one's account. It is a righteousness without work. That is, when Abraham was not circumcised. That is, his works are not imputed for righteousness, but on the other hand, his sin is imputed for unrighteousness apart from faith. Now, when it is said that faith is imputed for righteousness, as it is in the context of Romans 4, going back to Genesis 15:6, that cannot mean that faith as a work, in the sense in which Paul condemns work, that faith as a work is imputed, because righteousness is imputed without work, coris ergon. And therefore, the righteousness which is imputed is understood to be an alien righteousness, a righteousness which is imputed in the way of faith or by faith, the righteousness of another. And in any case, the imputation is an essential element in the justification, or what we're saying then is that when we think in terms of soteric justification, we think not only in terms of a declaration or a judgment, pure and simple, but conjoined with that or involved in that declaration, there is imputation. Imputation, which is the constitutive act to which reference is made in Romans 5:19. That constitutive act, which is an act of imputation, establishes a new relationship to the law which warrants the declaration of justification. Not only warrants it, but demands and ensures it, because the judgment of God is always according to truth. Now you note again that imputation belongs as much to the forensic category as does declaration. And again, it's not the subjective renewal or transformation that is in view, but an act of reckoning, and therefore belongs to the sphere of judgment rather than to the sphere of transformation. There is not an infusion of alien righteousness, but a reckoning of an alien righteousness to us as our own. And finally, I think, in the fourth place, justification includes the constitutive act. Justification includes the constitutive act. That's already been implied and more or less assumed in the remarks that I've made to this point, but we ought, I think, to come to a conscious awareness of this point. The question here is whether that constitutive act is actually included in the justification itself or is simply presupposed by justification. Well, there are arguments in favor of seeing that constitutive act, that imputation, as involved in the justification itself. Note, first of all, Romans 3:24, being justified as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, being justified as a gift. And that would suggest to us that the bare notion of declaration would not say all that Paul is saying by justification at that point, being justified as a gift, so being justified, as he writes elsewhere, through the reception of a gift, suggests to us that there may be more involved than a simple declaration. But then you have also Romans 5, verse 16. And if you look at that in the Greek, you'll notice that the word for justification at the end of the verse, eis dikaioma, is a distinctive word. Nouns ending in the mu alpha are not necessarily of Dutch derivation, although there are many Dutch names in the ma. But they are words that express the result of an action. And if that's the case, then you see the word is one which suggests more than a declaration. The dikaioma, that justification, involves some sort of action. Now, it may well be that this particular form, dikaioma, is chosen in order to conform this noun to a pattern which appears in the verse. There are a number of nouns which end in the mu alpha, dorema, prima, katakrima, charisma, and then finally dikaioma, so that you might, for a stylistic reason, have this word instead of dikaiosis. But again, in the same context, you have the idea of a gift of bestowal in verse 17. Then, as we noted in verse 19, the constituting of one is righteous, so that the effect is cumulative, and all of those forms, including the one in verse 18, point to justification and unfold various facets of it. But they seem also to be pointing to an action which is more than a simple declaration, includes this constitutive element. There's a third observation that could be made in this connection. And if you think of that declaration, that judgment of God speaking, then you might conclude that his word is powerful, just as his calling is effectual. That which God speaks is actually performed. When God speaks, what he speaks is called into existence. The same can be said with respect to adoption. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. 1 John 3, verse 1, suggesting that that calling actually brings us into the status of sons. The love is bestowed. Well, by analogy, the judgment denoted by justify is not simply one that recognizes a certain state as existing, but actually causes that existence to be. Not in the sense of transformation, but in the sense that what is declared to be actually is effectuated by the declaration itself. And so the act of imputation would be included in the dikaiō as applied to God's justification of the ungodly. And so the usage of dikaiō in connection with the subject of soteric justification would be distinctive. Now, is the argument clear to that point, John?
Doesn't walk in fear of judgment, is not an infusion of righteousness, but it is a parameter gap. Well, that seems to me to put it right there where we began, and I don't see the difference now between the power act, the imputation, the forensic imputation, and forensic justification.
Yeah, the first point that we made was to establish the forensic character of justification. By that we mean justification does not mean to make righteous, but to declare righteous. But how can you declare one righteous who is not righteous? Well, what is required is that the one who is unrighteous be constituted righteous. Not by transformation, but by a method which is consonant with the forensic character of justification. And that method is the method of imputation. Well, that's what forensic means.
Yeah, I know, but I understand that you can't make a judgment without having a person actually doing what we're judging. To make that person what they are, if you don't transform them, we have to constitute them by saying something with respect to them. I don't know, it seems like we're going around in circles.
No, the imputation is the reckoning of a righteousness to an ungodly person so that he is adjudged to be righteous, not on the ground of intrinsic transformation, but on the ground of an alien righteousness which is reckoned to him. Hank?
Yeah,
Righteousness, which is in view, whether you think in terms of infusion or whether you think in terms of imputation. Now, that's not quite accurate because, at least if you think historically in terms of the Roman Catholic conception, the righteousness which is infused in terms of the Roman Catholic conception is grace. And what that grace is a bit of a puzzle because of the understanding of the nature of Christ's death and all. But if we set that aside for a moment and simply think of the infusion of righteousness as, say, the righteousness of Jesus Christ, then certainly it's the same righteousness which is in view, whether conceived of as imputed or conceived of as infused. And it was exactly for that reason that Calvin made the most remarkable statement that there is no difference between us and the schoolmen as to the beginning of justification. That's literally in the Institutes. There's no difference between us and the schoolmen as to the beginning of justification. Now, I would say, yes, there is a difference in that the one conceives of that righteousness as infused, but the other conceives of it as imputed. But Calvin made his statement because it was the same righteousness in either case, you see. Now, why we have to think in terms of imputation rather than infusion will become apparent in a moment when we take up the subject of the righteousness which is imputed. So that's the next topic on our agenda. All right. You have the cuspis, say me. And the question is, now if you look at the translation of that, which is often in our English Bibles, made righteous, how in the world can you understand that except as subjective transformation? That's the direction in which our translations lead us. But you see, in the light of the context, and in the light of the established forensic character of justification, that kathistemi is not to be understood in terms of transformation, but is to be understood in terms of imputation. What is that being made righteous in terms of justification as it's unfolded in Paul? And then the argument is to be understood in terms of an imputation. Yeah. Well, I'm sure I'm not following your point on that. But
a Roman conception,
he wouldn't
see man totally free.
He wouldn't.
Well, that's my understanding.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's perfectly true in itself, but I'm not sure that that's relevant to the immediate, rather narrow point that we're dealing with here. I'm sorry, I should have asked you for your question before. Go ahead.
Let me see if I'm getting this right. Are you simply saying that Christ's righteousness is paralyzed and cast for his love, and reckoned as righteous, and that were declared by the congregations of that right.
Yeah.
And then the first of the constitutive acts was
yes, you've understood the two things right. The constitutive act is the imputation. The righteousness of Christ is imputed to us, and as imputed becomes the ground of our justification. But now the question is, and that was the fourth point with which I was dealing, are those two to be construed as two separate acts? And I suggested to you that no, they were to be construed as a single act, which is called justification, the dikaiō. Well, the way in which I put it was the act of justification, which is preeminently a declaration concerning an existent state, is unique with respect to soteric justification in that it includes an act of imputation, which then creates the act of the state which is declared to be. It sounds very complicated and very difficult, but it is for this reason that you have to make sure, or what we're trying to do, or what I'm trying to do is that instead of simply carrying along on slogans, that we try to see actually out of the Bible where these ideas come from, and I'm trying to make the best case I can for the idea of the imputation of the righteousness of Christ, which is essential to the historic doctrine. All right, sure. Right, and that's why some would say that that the imputation is presupposed by the declarative act. Go ahead. Okay. You see, the traditional language is, of course, the language of imputation. But we got at it this way, that since something is declared to be which does not, in fact, exist, therefore we have to be constituted such. All right, the Bible itself uses the katistemi, the constituted. Now, Romans 5:19. What does that mean, constituted, to be constituted righteous? Well, in the light of Romans 4, it's to be understood in terms of imputation, so that constitution, or being made, is to be understood as a reckoning to us of an alien righteousness. See, if you ask yourself, what is the biblical basis for the doctrine of imputation? Basically, there are three texts, Romans 5:19, 1 Corinthians 5:21, which speaks of our becoming the righteousness of God in Him. I'll speak about that in a moment. And the passages, the sequence that you have in Romans 4, which is the one place where the word imputation is used. And there, what you have most frequently is that faith is imputed for righteousness, but in verses 6 and 11, you have the expression, the imputation of righteousness. And that's understood then in conjunction with Romans 5:19, 1 Corinthians 5:21. John?
The Romans view, like a corporation, bankrupt, God gives the corporation the ability to pay back its debt by producing enough product. The Protestant view is that God makes the books balance. He then gives the the money to pay the debt, and then also at the same time declare the human heel.
I'm not so sure that your illustration is particularly helpful. It's not my intention at this point to deal with the Roman Catholic doctrine, but if it would help you, I wouldn't mind at least saying a few words about it.
In the Roman Catholic instruction, you have an unjust man. Now, what happens is, if you want to use an economic metaphor or simile, good money drives out the bad money. That is to say, through the infusion of justness, or justitia justice, through the infusion of justice, injustice or evil is actually expelled. See? So that the unjust man becomes a just man. And this just man is considered to be what he actually is. Okay? That's the beginning of justification. In the Protestant view, this unjust man is in himself continues to be an unjust man. Now I'm going to have to qualify that because the Reformed spoke differently than the Lutherans on that point. But just pursuing, say, the Lutheran position. The unjust man remains an unjust man. That's the simul justus efficatur. Efficatur. He remains an unjust man. But there is reckoned to him a righteousness in terms of which he is judged. So he is judged not in terms of what he is himself, but in terms of what is reckoned to him. So that it is the reckoning of a righteousness to him which drives out or expels the reckoning of his own unrighteousness to him. So that the thing takes place in the forensic sphere rather than in the sphere of moral transformation. That's the difference between the two. Well, that's what Roman Catholics have always said about the Protestant doctrine. And the answer to it from the Protestant side has said, no, it's not an abomination because the righteousness of Christ is not a fiction. You see? And then Calvin would go on to say, as Luther also did say, that this unjust man is not left simply as an unjust man, but he is progressively sanctified. Okay, David?
What you're saying then,
and we haven't even come to the problematical area.
The forensic nature of justification is both vindictive and declarative, right?
Well, you don't say the forensic nature of justification is both. Justification is a declarative act which includes an imputation, and for that reason is forensic in character. Okay. Fine. I hope you'll give it back on the test. Okay, now we come to number three, which is the righteousness imputed. The righteousness imputed, or the ground of justification. Now, what I have to say here has already been anticipated in one way or another, and that's virtually impossible. It's impossible to avoid that because you're dealing with a complex whole. But the precise question is, granted that there is an imputation of righteousness in the justifying act, what precisely is that righteousness which is imputed? On what grounds are we justified? Now, abstractly speaking, not concretely the way John likes to speak, but abstractly speaking, that righteousness could be conceived of in a variety of ways. It could be conceived of as an infused righteousness, a righteousness which becomes ours by infusion, spoken of as a righteousness which is wrought in us. Or you could think of it as a righteousness which we work out for ourselves, which we bring forth out of ourselves. Now the point there is that the Bible says that our sin is imputed to us as transgression. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute his sin. Well, that implies that the Lord does impute the sins of some people to them. He holds them accountable for their sins. And those sins are their own actual transgressions. Now, you see, positively, on the other side, you could also say that the righteousness which is imputed is a righteousness which is infused. You see, the notion of infusion and imputation are not contradictory. They don't necessarily exclude one another. An infused righteousness could be the righteousness that is imputed. So those two terms are not mutually exclusive, abstractly speaking. So that when we come to the righteousness which is imputed to us, it could be a righteousness which is infused in us, abstractly speaking. So that brings us to the first point, which is this, that the ground of justification cannot be an inherent righteousness. The ground of justification cannot be an inherent righteousness. Ground, again, means that righteousness on the basis of which, on account of which we are justified, cannot be an inherent righteousness, whether conceived of as infused or conceived of as worked out by us. Okay, go ahead. Now you're getting ahead of me, and don't give my lecture before I get it, otherwise it doesn't make a good impression. No, the point here is, remember in the first lecture we said the difference between Reformation and Rome doesn't turn on the difference whether justification is moral or forensic. Both can conceive of it as forensic. Even Rome can say, we believe in justification on the basis of an imputed righteousness. And by that means that the righteousness which is imputed is the righteousness which is actually infused in us. See? So to say that we believe in an imputed righteousness doesn't describe the difference between Rome and Reformation. We have to go on to argue, to show, as I'm going to try to do now, that that ground of justification cannot be an infused righteousness which is imputed to us. Well, how do we see that? First of all, the ground of justification cannot be an infused righteousness. Cannot be an infused righteousness because such an infused righteousness would not suffice to measure up to what is involved in justification. It doesn't meet the needs of justification for several reasons. Such a righteousness is not sufficient to deal with sins that are past. The sins of the past result in a liability to punishment, and that liability to punishment is not dealt with by the infusion of righteousness or by the infusion of grace. You see, in the Roman Catholic conception, the infusion of righteousness expels sin, and the expulsion of sin means that you're perfect, and therefore there is nothing to be punished. But that way of looking at it does not take account of the sins previously committed and which themselves merit condemnation apart from what might be the case at the present time. Even if today I am made perfect, I still bear the liability of sins that are past, and therefore an infused righteousness reckoned to me or imputed to me does not take account of the transgressions of time past. But if justification means anything for us, it means what Romans 8:1 says, there is therefore now no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus. And therefore, the righteousness which is necessary for that kind of freedom from condemnation must be a righteousness which has application to sins that are past. But an infused righteousness does not do that. The only righteousness which does that is the righteousness of Jesus Christ in its fullness. That righteousness which on the one hand entails passive obedience, the suffering of the penalty of sin, as well as active obedience. And then there's a second point to be made in that connection, and that has reference to the sins of the future. You see, once that righteousness is infused, you are at that moment, to be sure, perfect. And the thought is not that you're infused for 90%, but that grace, in the Roman Catholic system at least, the grace which is infused in baptism completely expels original sin, so that it's for 100%. Now you see, that's a variety of perfectionism, really. And not only that, but you would have to be 100% perfect as you moved on from day to day. But that contradicts both the experience of the believer and the testimony of Scripture, which says that the believer does sin. Now, that infused righteousness, although it might warrant a justifying verdict at a given point, is not sufficient to secure the believer against liability for sins that are committed after the initial act of faith. Now, the Roman Catholic system recognizes that fact, and that is exactly why the sacrament of baptism is supplemented with a series of sacraments which are designed to counter what happens later in the experience of the faithful in the Roman Catholic sense. So that's the reason why the righteousness which is imputed cannot, in the first place, be an infused righteousness. And in the second place, and this, I don't have room on the slide, but this would be beta under the alpha. The ground of justification cannot be a righteousness which is wrought out by us. It's not a righteousness which is wrought out by us. Now here, the biblical warrant for saying that is the repeated emphasis in the New Testament that we are not justified by the work of the law. Romans 3, verse 20, Romans 4, verse 2, 10, verses 3 and 4, Galatians 2, 16, Galatians 3, 11, 5, 4, Philippians 3, 9, Titus 3, 5. Let me just repeat those quickly. Romans 3, 20, 4, 2, 10, 3, and 4. And then three passages from Galatians 2, 16, 3, 11, and 5, 4. Then from Philippians 3, verse 9, and Titus 3, verse 5. We are not justified on the basis of a righteousness which is wrought out by us, what the Apostle Paul calls the work of the law. If you want to understand what Paul means by the work of the law, then you can see that very clearly at the beginning of Galatians 3. O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified? Let me ask you only this. Did you receive the Spirit by the work of the law or by hearing with faith? Works of the law set over against hearing with faith. Are you so foolish, having begun with the Spirit, are you now ending with the flesh? Faith and Spirit belong together. Works of the law and the power of the flesh belong together. The works of the law are, in the view of the Apostle Paul, the effort of the flesh to bring forth a righteousness which suffices. Now, it's important to bear that in mind, because when Paul uses the expression works of the law, he has very concretely in view the Mosaic system. The Apostle Paul did not write on the background of the declarations of the Council of Trent. He lived many years before the Council of Trent. He wrote on the background of the Mosaic system and the effort of the Judaizers to reintroduce the Mosaic system. And that Mosaic system in the history of redemption, being a system before Christ, was, from the point of view of the history of redemption, a Christless system. And therefore, appealed to the flesh. And that's why the flesh reacted to the law by multiplying transgression. That's Romans 7. Now, says Paul, in terms of that system, you cannot be justified, because it's a system which appeals to the flesh. Now you can make the application to what Trent said, see, by understanding what Trent was speaking about as also in its own way and in its distinctive way, because Trent did not ask for a reestablishment of animal sacrifices. Trent did not ask for the reinstitution of the Mosaic system, but what it did advocate was a system which appealed to the flesh. That has always been crucial to the Roman Catholic understanding of the nature of man, no total depravity, the appeal to the flesh. And that's the relevance of the Apostle Paul for the Roman Catholic era. And what we are left with is a clear understanding that the righteousness on the ground of which we are justified cannot be a righteousness which is wrought out by us. And the chief reason for that is that in the first place, we don't ever work out such a righteousness. And secondly, salvation is so exclusively bound up with Jesus Christ and his righteousness that it's utterly inconceivable that the righteousness could come in any other way. If it could, then Jesus would not have died. But it can't come in any other way. And therefore, justification is not by a righteousness which is wrought out by us. Now, when you combine infused righteousness, or when you see that infused righteousness doesn't work, that a righteousness which is wrought out by us doesn't work, then you see that our thesis is supported, that the ground of justification cannot be an inherent righteousness. Over against that, positively, and here we would come to B, the ground of justification must be an alien righteousness. A justitia aliena, an alien righteousness. And the Bible makes that clear in various ways. First of all, the Bible tells us that justification is by grace. Justification is by grace. But I have to stop there. Because it's the end of the hour.